Welcome back to Tangential Banter. My name is Ben Mowell, and I'm here with my co-host, Jack Korzenowski.
What's up, y'all?
What is up? Well, as we record this, we are in the middle of the, what are they calling it? Polar bomb or
Oh, I saw that just today.
bomb
It's
cyclone?
a bomb cyclone, which I had never heard of that term before. And when I first saw the headline, because it was something like, what's the storm's name? Is it Elliot?
I think so.
So
Yeah.
it was you know what? I wonder if I go to the Weather Channel, which is where I saw the yeah, here it is. Breaking news. Elliot is bomb cyclone.
Nice.
And I read that and I was like, you mean like Elliot is a super cool cyclone? Like, what do you mean bomb? Like Elliot is
Means
hella
like
tight cyclone.
it's like a few years ago when they announced that the sun's mass is like in the order of 10 to the 27 kilograms or whatever, and they announced that in scientific notation 10 to the 27th was going to be a hella prefix, so it was like
No, really?
the sun was like one helagram.
Oh
Yeah,
my gosh, it's hilarious.
so it's kind of like that. Yeah, it's
That's
a
awesome.
hella storm.
Hella tight. That actually would have a scientific meaning. Just like a butt. Ben, you could legitimately have a hella butt of something.
Halibut,
A
yeah.
hella butt. Wow.
Not a halibut,
Not a, yeah. That's hella butt, yo. Oh my gosh.
well,
We need to lobby the scientific community to make this happen.
I think they were, it was an attempt to make themselves a little more hip and relevant with the younger. But so my, this is not the topic we prepped for, but I was having a conversation about this exact thing, this bomb cyclone topic, with my brother the other day, because it was just like, when did winter storms in the Midwest get names, or when did we start calling everything with these like polar vortex, bomb cyclone? Like, they've developed this apocalyptic language for winter storms that has
Except when it
never been
comes to
used
the
before.
actual name. Elliot just does not sound intimidating.
Yeah. That's true. But it was like we just decided that the weather stations or the weathermen, whatever, must be getting bored. And so they want to like try to compete with the coasts for natural disasters, that actually have significance. And so we got to dress it up with some crazy language, make it sound important.
And bomb cyclone certainly, it grabs your attention. I'll give him that.
Yes. And then it's like, people in Florida are talking about, well, I've lived through three hurricanes, and we can say, yeah, but did you live through a bomb cyclone?
Bomb
Didn't think
cyclone. Whoa. Oh, look at this. So I just looked up bomb cyclone on Wikipedia, and it redirected me to a page titled, and I'm not making this up, Explosive Cyclogenesis. Explosive
wow.
cyclogenesis, also referred to a weather bomb or a meteorological bomb or explosive development bomb cyclone or bomb or bombogenesis, is the rapid deepening of an extratropical cyclonic low pressure area. The change in pressure needed to classify something as explosive cyclogenesis is latitude dependent. For example, at 60% latitude, explosive cyclogenesis occurs if the central pressure decreases by 24 millibar or more in 24 hours. This is a predominantly maritime winter event, but also occurs in continental settings, evidently, even in the summer. This process is the extratropical equivalent of the tropical rapid deepening. Although their cyclogenesis is entirely different from that of tropical cyclones, bomb cyclones can produce winds of 74 to 95 miles an hour, or in kilometers per hour. I'm not going to give those numbers because I'm not going to validate that measuring system. The same order as the first categories of the Saffir-Simpson scale and yield heavy precipitation. Even though only a minority of the bombs become so strong, some weaker ones have also caused significant damage. That sounds a lot to me. like, hey, we're just going to classify this because we have nothing better to do with our time. Kind of like what you just said, regurgitating your conclusion.
What is the bottom, if you, does it say when that article was written? Like 2 weeks ago?
Well, this is a Wikipedia page. So at best, it's going to give me when last edited date, but I'm not seeing one.
What about under references? Does it show like the age of the references or anything like that?
References. Fierce weather bomb, and those are in quotes, batters Britain. That was from 2011. So maybe the fact that they put weather bomb in quotes means that it was a relatively unknown term at the time. What the heck is a bomb cyclone? That's from 2018. Oh, here we are. May 20th, 2005. Bomb cyclones ravage northwestern Atlantic.
Okay.
That's 2005. Oh, 1988. Explosive cyclogenesis over the eastern United States. There's an article referencing that bombogenesis term, but it doesn't have a date on it.
Okay, so it's been around at least, what, 30-some years then?
Hasn't
made it to the vernacular.
Yeah, bomb cyclone.
Also, explosive cyclogenesis sounds like it could be an alternative way of saying the Big Bang.
Kind of does. It does not sound like a weather term.
Yeah.
It sounds almost like a nuclear reaction sort of thing. Explosive cyclogenesis.
Which I guess cyclogenesis being the beginning of a cyclone, and it's explosive because it happens rapidly in weather climate terms. But yeah, I don't know, man. It's like the opposite of a euphemism. What's the opposite of a euphemism anyway? You know, because euphemism, you're taking something that somewhat sounds bad or unpleasant and trying to soften it up.
You know? Oh, kind of like a, yeah.
Instead of saying someone died, you say they passed away. But this is the opposite of that. This is like trying to make it sound even worse.
Maybe I
should make a word for that.
Yeah, it's like an anti-euphemism.
So you means good, that prefix, generally speaking. So what's a euphemism? Maybe a confirmism.
Confirmism, yeah. Con, I think that's Latin or Germanic, maybe. The U is Greek. What would be the Greek? So instead of euphemism, it'd be ophanism, maybe?
I don't know. We're making it up on the fly here. It's a thing now.
It's really tough because neither of us know a lick of Greek. At least I don't think. I know I don't.
I know a couple of letters. That's about it.
Oh, it's euphemism, not euphonism, like I thought it was. Oh, look at that. Oh, euphemism comes from the Greek euphemos, which means uttering sounds of good omen, fair sounding or auspicious. The first part is the root of that root is the prefix eu, meaning good, just as you said, golden star, Ben. And the second part is phemos, a Greek word for speech. So probably the same Greek word that we get like phonetics from, maybe, or phone, maybe.
Actually, so here's where I would go with it. I'm going to call all the way back to freshman year of high school. We had a health class and we learned about distress and eustress, because we talked about how some stress is good for you. So that's eustress. Distress is a more negative connotation.
Okay.
In this case, if we take that prefix, we could say dysphemism.
Dysphemism. Let's do it.
Would be taking something every day and making it sound apocalyptic.
Yep.
Dysphemism.
Dysphemism. I like the, it has like an, it sounds almost onomatopoeic, like dysphemism sounds like you're making something bad. You know, it's
it does have the dis in there too, like you're dissing it.
Yeah. And the phimism part sounds like, you know, ooh, it's Greek, it's ominous. Like
Is Greece?
apocalypse.
Yeah. That's, see, we do know some Greek.
Which, if so, I was listening to a Bible Project podcast one day, and they said that the word apocalypse, like the Greek word that that comes from, it doesn't mean end of the world. It just means like a revelation,
Yes.
like a truth
Yeah.
coming out. But it isn't actually like, you know, oh, the end is nigh sort of thing.
Yeah, I think it's come to take that meaning, right? Because of John's revelation is about the end of the world. So it's like the like capital R revelation has become synonymous with end of the world, whereas really any type of generic revelation with a lowercase r is just something being
Revealed.
disclosed or uncovered. Yeah, revealed.
Which I think is where revelation comes from. It's the revelation, I think.
So,
Anyway.
given the turn that this conversation took, I feel like I'd be doing it a disservice if we didn't at least mention some of the other things that we've talked about in the past where people are trying to make themselves look important or keep themselves busy. Like some of the very well-known, well-established, commonplace foods. Like Doritos or Mountain Dew or Fritos, sorry, not Fritos, Oreos.
Yep.
And then they come out with these special editions like every couple of months. They're only on the shelf for a limited period of time. They got fancy packaging, whatever. But it's essentially the same thing, just with a slightly different flavor, a little twist.
Right. Okay. Yeah, you want to move on to this topic. Okay, let's do it. Because I think you're right, it does fit in. Yeah. I mean, and we've discussed it outside the podcast. I think that they're just coming up. So, like, again, just to reinforce what the topic is, right? If you go to, like, it used to just be you'd buy Oreos, and that's all that there really was. There was just Oreos and maybe double stuffed, or but then they came out with like thin Oreos, and then, oh, what about mint Oreos or like peanut butter Oreos? And then they get all this really wacky flavors now. And it's the same thing with Doritos. It used to be like, oh, nacho and Cool Ranch, you know, or it was probably just nacho cheese at first. And they said, what about this Cool Ranch flavor? Oh, wait, what about this like bar, like, you know, buffalo? What about hamburger flavored Doritos? Have you ever had a hamburger flavored Dorito, Ben?
I think I have. I don't remember if it was a Dorito or if it was another brand, but I'm pretty sure I'm 100% sure I've had some hamburger flavored chips. Yes.
I've only had them like once or twice. When I did have them, I was like, holy cow, this tastes exactly like a hamburger. Or a cheeseburger, whichever one it was. But it was
Yeah, it's
crazy how like it was identical to if you were to go take a chomp out of a Big Mac or something. I don't know
Yeah,
how they
which
did that.
is
I'm not sure if I want to know how they did that.
Yeah, or what it does to your body, but
Right, all the chemicals they use.
it is such a weird experience where I guess I'd say it's surreal, where the flavor it does not match the texture whatsoever,
Yep.
right? It's like, yeah, this flavor is definitely cheeseburger, but the crunch is not cheeseburger. It is impressive though how they do that.
But
So
right, so we've observed this, that you have all of these normally kind of junk food stuff, and all that they're really doing is just coming out with different flavors, and they're otherwise not improving or otherwise changing the product. They're just coming out with different variations of it. Right, that's the observation that we made.
right. And it seems like in these scenarios, they're really, and this is just from the outside, so I'm curious what the actual numbers are, but it seems like they're competing against themselves in that case, because like Oreos are a well-established, well-selling product where people are like, yeah, I'll go to the store and get some Oreos. I don't think in most cases people are like, oh, I'm going to go to the store and get the peanut butter flavored Oreos. You just happen to be in the aisle looking for Oreos, and you're like, oh, there's a peanut butter flavor. Maybe I'll get those instead.
Or mix and
So it's
match
not
it with
like,
normals and peanut butter or something.
yeah, but I don't feel like they're, and maybe they are, just because of maybe it preys upon like the human interest in novelty and like being attracted to things that are kind of like interesting. I don't know.
Ooh,
I'd
like,
be curious if it actually increases sales, you know?
right, because maybe it's like this. Maybe I think you're right that that they can compete with themselves, where it's like, I'm going to go to the store and get Oreos. Oh, wait, they have peanut butter flavored Oreos. I'll get those instead of the normal Oreos that I came here for. That's one scenario. What I'm guessing they're actually going for is I'm going to the store to get cheese and steak or something. Oh, I see they have normal Oreos, whatever, had those before. Oh, wait a minute. They have peanut butter Oreos now? Oh, I got to get those. And I got to try
Yeah.
those out. Maybe that's what they're shooting for. Because what was our original theory, Ben, as to why they kept, as they kept coming up with these theory with these different flavors?
Well, the original theory was, Oreo employs so many people in marketing and branding and advertising who are like, well, how else do we sell the Oreo again? We've been selling it for whatever it is, 60 years or something. And, yeah, if I don't come up with something, it's going to look like my job's kind of disposable here. So we better make something snappy.
Yeah, same thing
And I
with
guess with
the
the chemists
engineers.
too,
Yeah.
right? The whole team
They're sitting here saying, well,
justifying their existence.
we perfected the Oreo about, looks at his watch, 25 years ago. What are we going to do now? We need something to do, man. We'll just come up with these
Yeah,
random flavors.
and they're obviously introducing additional costs for the other flavors and separate, manufacturing processes and whatever. So, it must be, like you said, the scenario where people who weren't planning to buy Oreos or any kind of cookie necessarily will see a new flavor and go, oh, that's worth a try. And that generates enough sales to make it worthwhile.
I wonder if that's why, Ben, a lot of companies, and I can't remember if this was related to this topic, a completely different topic, or maybe not even a topic at all, but why companies like the McRib is a great example. Why do they only offer them at certain periods of time? Why not just have the McRib around all the time if it's so successful? And I think that's because they basically want to take one product, but from it reap the benefits of coming up with a bunch of different flavors or variants throughout the years. Because if you release the McRib and you keep it on the menu forever, indefinitely, then the novelty of the McRib is going to wear off. Everybody is going to say, I know what a McRib tastes like. It's pretty good, and I know I can get one at any time, and I'm not really feeling like paying for one right now, so I'm not going to get it. But if they take it away, or excuse me, then if McDonald's is in that scenario, then they realize, oh shoot, we have to come up with a new sandwich. So maybe they, make the McGangbang an official item on the menu. So everybody's like, oh, I got to get a McGangbang. It's on the menu now. I got to do it. And then a lot of people do it. And if the McGangbang stays on the menu, then they're all going to be like, well, I know what it tastes like. It's okay. I can get one at any time. I don't feel like paying for one right now. But if McDonald's is like, what if we take the McRib off the menu? And then everybody's going to say, all the corporate people are going to say, what are you talking about? But then we release it at a later time. So then people would be like, a McRib, I haven't had one forever. It's only going to be a limited time. I got to go get one. And this is somebody who otherwise may not have been going to McDonald's at all. In fact, that has come to my mind whenever I see the McRib is back on the menu. I have caught myself thinking, maybe I'll go get one. It's been about a decade.
Yeah, so it's like an artificial scarcity, right? And then they can make it an event when it comes back. Like it's a special event, and there's a sense that it's a limited time, so you got to go now to go get it. You can't wait. Don't delay, right? And then once you get there for your McRib, which I don't know why you would because they're gross, but once you get there to buy your McRib, they're also selling fries and drinks and other things that wouldn't have been sold otherwise for the
Right.
people who are there to get their once in a decade McRib kind of thing.
Yep. So maybe that's the purpose between all of these different like chip and cookie flavors. But the thing is, right, they're taking the different approach. It's not like Doritos releases the hamburger flavor for like a month and then takes it away. And it's not like they only bring it out every July 4th. And then they, hey, look at that. Then it could become like it's a July 4th tradition where you have to get the hamburger Doritos, and that could up sales. But they're not doing that. They're just keeping the flavors all on the shelves all the time, or at least it certainly seems that way to
well,
me. And then they're coming; they have to keep belting out different flavors.
They do. I think it's more of a rotation. So it's like they'll be on the shelf for, you know, summer months, and then they'll be gone in the winter months, and there'll be something else. But it does remind me of a thought I've had actually just today, because if you go to the store, it, like after Thanksgiving, just about any store has containers of eggnog, and you can also get like sparkling grape juice, and you know, before Thanksgiving you can get cranberry sauce, things like that. And if you look for those things at almost any other time of the year, you may be able to find them, but you probably got to hunt to several different stores before you can find it, or they've only got like one on the shelf. And it's had me wondering, like, you know, for the big dairies that make eggnog, for example, when did they start producing it and when did they stop? Because I'm sure by this point, I'm sure by now they are no longer making eggnog, right? They probably stopped making eggnog like maybe the middle of the month or something. But what are their like production ranges? And then how do they handle products that are like mad around Thanksgiving, but you're only selling it for like lunch meat in between? I'm just been curious to know for some of those companies how they handle very seasonal products, and how they balance that with their normal products, you know, because it, like a dairy has to balance making eggnog with all their other milk products. So I wonder if they have like an eggnog line that only is used for 2 months out of the year when they ramp up for Christmas, or if they, you know, divert part of one of their normal lines for eggnog production when it comes to that time of year.
Yeah, because this could be a similar idea to Doritos and Oreos coming out with different flavors, where Doritos and Oreos, again, this is assuming that I'm using them as a nominal example. I'm assuming that their model is keep every flavor we've ever made on the shelf, which I don't think is true, but for simplicity's sake, keep every flavor we've ever made on the shelf at all times. And then we just, as sales start to drop, because people are always like, yeah, I know I can get my favorite flavor at any time, they'll release a new flavor to kind of boost sales again. Because again, it's like, oh, you know, Oreos has a hot habanero Oreo now, I got to try it. Whereas the McRib is just taking the one product and recycling it over and over. And they're sacrificing sales in the lull in the hopes of that the craze of it coming back is going to get them more sales than had it just stayed around all the time. And then I think the eggnog scenario is one that the industry isn't necessarily pushing. It's just slave to the culture. Like, I don't think anybody would drink eggnog for 4th of July, even if the dairy industry
made it
at the time. I think the dairy industries are like, look, people are only going to drink eggnog from Thanksgiving through probably sometime in January or February when it's cold, and mostly around Christmas time. We shouldn't bother trying to sell it in the summer or making it in the summer, right? That's the thing. You can't just make eggnog all year round at a really slow pace, bunch it all up, and then sell it all at once. You know, it's a dairy product. It only keeps so long. So you're right. Do they have one line? I'm guessing that they just convert the lines so that the other parts of the year it's making something else. But I don't know dairy factories.
It could also be like they may have so the thought I had was for like Doritos, right? They could just have a specialty flavor line or multiple ones, right? And so it's like they've got their main lines that are always producing the nacho cheese and Cool Ranch and whatever. And then they've got some other smaller ones that are making all these specialties. And so it doesn't really matter which specialty they're making. They make it for a period of time and they just run that and then switch over to a new specialty. And I think similar for like eggnog, a lot of these other, like a dairy, that could be one of their lower volume lines, you know, whatever that might be, if it's whipping cream or chocolate milk or whatever, right? And then they switch it over for a short period of time and divert some of that capability for eggnog. Or maybe they've got eight lines that are all doing whole milk, and so they take one of the eight and convert it to eggnog. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. We'll never know.
So if anyone out there listening knows how eggnog is made, or any of these foods, and how they handle some of the change to and from the shelf and all the distribution and advertising and all that stuff, because it's not just the product, right? It's the whole thing. You've got to get pushed out, make people aware that it's going to be back, all that kind of stuff. It's kind of impressive, honestly, to have that much turnover in your product line and still be able to manage the complexity of it.
Right.
But it's also frustrating as a consumer where, probably when I was in high school or maybe in college, Mountain Dew came out with a flavor called Pitch Black, which was kind of like a... Have you had it?
No, but we've talked about this before. It's blackberry?
Yeah.
Or something like that?
It's like a weird kind of a berry flavor, kind of a dark grape.
Sure.
Anyway, I thought it was really good. And it's one of those that's... It comes out periodically. So they've had like two or three different versions of it. And then they'll sometimes have it at Halloween. And now I think Buffalo Wild Wings has, I can't remember what they call it, like
Mountain
Dew Wild or something. But I think it's a similar flavor. I don't think it's a brand new flavor.
I thought you were going to say they have Mountain Dew pitch flavored chicken wings.
That'd be bad. Or Blazin' Mountain Dew would also be bad.
Oh, no.
But anyway, so it's one of those things where it's like a company comes out with a product that you really like, and then they go into one of these cycles where it's either temporary or it's on a rotation or it's seasonal or whatever. And then it's like, well, what am I supposed to do for the rest of the year? Do I stock up and just have a hoarded cache of it that I go back to, or do I just deal with the fact that I'm only going to get it once a year? You know, like, it's very frustrating when you find something that you really, really enjoy.
Maybe they do that on purpose, though, because then when you see it on the shelves, you are going to be very inclined to buy it. And maybe like your case with the Mountain Dew Pitch Black, you're maybe the exception or like the minority where it's like, no, I would buy it like regularly around
right.
the calendar. I bet most of the people who result in sales, according to their studies or analysis or whatever, wouldn't do that. And they are really only buying it when they see it come back on the shelves and they're like, oh, I got to get some. And then they do. But if they didn't have that, if it was just on the shelves indefinitely, they would rarely, if ever, get it. So the only way to get sales out of the majority, this is my speculation, remember, the only way they can get sales out of that product is, or the most effective way to get sales out of the product, I'll put it that way, is to, you know, retire it and then bring it back. Everybody gets excited, buys it, and then they pull it back again, just like McRib, just repeat that cycle.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Voltage flavor is one that came up through, this is probably a decade ago now, but they had like a summer where they ran competitions between, I think it was three flavors one summer and then three flavors the next. And eventually they kept the flavor that sold the best. And I think Voltage was the one that was on this like limited edition basis and then became part of their permanent profile, or not profile, portfolio.
Hmm.
But it's all, I think, would be a fascinating study for like a marketing class, right? Of the seasonality or forced scarcity of food products.
But you know what? This really doesn't go, this is related, but isn't quite the same in spirit to the point that we were observing in the first place, which is companies that don't really follow this model, like Doritos and Oreos, like you, and again, I don't actively buy a specific flavor of Doritos on the reg, so I guess I wouldn't know if this is true. I would think that it is most of the time, where if you want a specific flavor of Oreo, you're probably going to find one. You're probably going to find it nearby. And maybe that's not true. But if that is, like, assuming that is true, which again, it may not be, the it's just funny to think how like all of, like it, I guess the point I was even trying to make is all that the food engineers and like the chemists can really do at this point is release new flavors, because the Oreo was perfected so long ago. The Dorito was perfected so long ago. So what can they can't do anything else but make different flavors. They'd be out of a job if they didn't do that. And I'm half wondering if they're coming up with these flavors and working their butts off to convince their executives to give them the money and the engine and, you know, the salaries to do it, where, because I'm wondering if even the CEOs or the people in charge at least are saying, what, you know, guys, maybe we do have enough flavors right now, let's cut costs back and let's just reap in the rewards, you know what I mean? And then the actual product managers have to, like, you know, work tooth and nail to approve like every new project just to keep their team employed.
I feel like there's got to be enough in the psychology of the whole thing that drives profit. Like, you could put out just about any flavor you wanted as a limited edition or as part of your rotation, and you would generate enough interest to make it worth your while. When you have a product that's that well established in the marketplace, and then it's just variations of that. Because I feel like otherwise it wouldn't, it's not like they're fundamentally improving on the concept of the Oreo, right? Because I would guess that the standard Oreos, either regular, double stuff, or whatever, are still probably, I don't know, 75% of their volume, 80% of their volume. And so all these specialty ones are, it's not like that's gradually taking over a larger and larger portion of Oreo sales. You know what I mean? So they're still not, even with all the variation, they're still not improving on the Oreo. People still want the original, and that's their primary product.
Yep.
So this other stuff, it's just like a, I think just by changing it, they get more sales. And so it works out financially to make it happen. You know, like they could make a black pepper Oreo and there are probably still people who would buy it to try it.
Right? I was even thinking like Oreo, now in wasabi flavor.
Yeah. You think they're mint and they're wasabi?
Oh. Oreos, but try our new sauerkraut cream.
So that reminded me of another trend, which is all the different products that are now getting the like Flamin' Hot treatment.
Oh.
Right, because it came to, I actually don't know if it started with Cheetos, but they started offering Flamin' Hot Cheetos, and I think it actually came from like Takis. I don't know if you ever had those.
No.
But they're like a Hispanic snack that are like tortilla chips that are rolled up and fried, and then they're seasoned with like different types of chili stuff. And I think that's the influence that started Cheetos to make Flamin' Hot. But anyway, ever since then, it's like you can get Flamin' Hot, like Taco Bell was doing Flamin' Hot macaroni and cheese bites or something. Not Taco Bell. I can't remember who did it. Or I'm pretty sure it was Mountain Dew, or maybe it was somebody else had. Maybe it was an April Fool's joke, but had released like a Flamin' Hot type of pop as a flavor for like a limited edition thing.
Oh.
But so it's like one product that's very successful that then gets integrated into a bunch of other products, right? And you could say the same about Oreos too, where they've now become a staple in a lot of different types of ice cream, or people will make an Oreo pie crust. Or even put them in cakes, that kind of stuff, right? Where it's now ubiquitous in any type of confection.
Huh.
I don't know where I was going with that. It's just an observation. So, any final thoughts to add to that topic? If not, we can swing around to where we intended to start.
I was actually going to say, now that we talked about it, I think we at least speculated. What's the word I'm looking for? We just in speculation, not looking anything up, we actually did come up with a couple of valid reasons why these companies are either coming up with like a bunch of different flavors for a food product that otherwise has remained the same. Like they're just coming up with different variations of it, but they're not improving the base product. Like they're not making the Dorito chips bigger or smaller or differently shaped or having a different base ingredients. Or the same thing with the Oreo. Like you buy an Oreo from 25 years ago or 30 or maybe even 40 years ago, probably looks like nearly identical and tastes nearly identical to what it would look like today. Maybe I'm wrong. So even if they're not improving that, they're still finding ways to get more money out of the product by changing these flavors or taking even products away then reintroducing them cyclically, which kind of makes it me disappointed that we came up with a rational reason why they're doing it. Because I just wanted to, I wanted to just keep thinking that these Oreo engineers are sitting in their cubicles at work saying, what do we do now, man? We're going to get fired. Like we need like come up with a random flavor fast. Like, you know what I mean?
Banana cream pie. Strawberry.
Flaming hot. Sure, everybody's on that trend now.
He's just the new guy's just really nervous. And he like thinks he gets the direction that the conversation is going, where you just throw out a flavor and it's like, dude, that totally doesn't fit at all.
But maybe it would, just although, because everybody, it's so crazy, it just might work.
It's the out of the box thinking that we need around here.
Yeah.
Although that did, as you were saying that, it did lead me to another potential reason that I hadn't thought of before, which is this. It may be that creating variants on the fringes of your core product is also a way of fighting off competitors from entering the market. Mm. And I say that because think of like if Oreo is just making their base Oreo, right? And then some random dude on the street decided that banana cream pie Oreos would be the next big thing, or a banana cream pie sandwich cookie.
That actually sounds amazing. I'm not even a huge fan of banana cream pie. I got to look this up. Banana cream pie Oreo.
They're probably already out there. Maybe that's where I got the idea. I don't know.
Not seeing them. Oh, gross. Oh, no. There's a fizzy orange Oreo.
What? Like Pop Rocks?
What is this product? Hold on. I got to take a little bit of a detour here. Oreo fizzy orange. These special edition Oreos from Thailand have an orange soda flavored cream filling? No. Oh, no. No. Ooh, there's a vanilla caramel, but no, not the fizzy orange, man. That's disgusting. Oh, they have a strawberry cream.
Okay.
They have an ice cream. Okay, but no, fizzy orange. That's too far. If they called it like
orange flavored Coke, right?
Oh God, no.
They started selling that in the U.S. a couple years ago.
No. Don't say that.
So, where I was going to say though is that
cola if you should not have a citrusy flavor. It shouldn't. It's just wrong. Which is ironic because one of the sweet
they have citric acid.
They have citric acid. Yeah.
So, where I was going with that though is that if you or I decided we were going to make banana cream pie Oreos, right, and Oreo wasn't already offering that, that would be an avenue for us to get into the marketplace if there was a large enough demand for Oreo cream pie sandwich cookies.
Right. I see what you're saying.
So I think by having these like random flavors on the fringes, it kind of deters people from jumping in with a new type of sandwich cookie because they know Oreo can respond or Nabisco can respond really rapidly, right? If you start to come up with something, some new flavor, if it's only a flavor, they are going to squash you within a couple months because they can react and have something else in the market.
Oh yeah. Good point. So keeps them on their toes, keeps them flexible. And it also by coming up with all these different flavors, you're saying that again, if they just had the normal Oreo and somebody came out with a banana cream pie flavored Oreo, then they may get big and become a competitor to Oreo. But if Oreo has all these different flavors, and you know what, even if they're bold enough and they still try to introduce it to the market, they may have sales for their banana cream pie or like, you know, Oreo knockoff. But Oreo has all these different flavors that only a small portion are getting that banana cream pie flavor.
Right.
They're kind of saturating the market with options so that if you try to introduce another option in there, there's only so many people who would buy it. Because a lot of people would say, oh, or banana cream pie, Oreons sound good. But you know what else sounds really good? These fizzy orange Oreos. And then that's when you escort this person to the back of the store and knock them upside the head with a 2x4.
I like that you called them Oreons. What if we called them, what if we came up with a brand called Orions?
Oh. But we pronounce it Oreons?
Yeah. So, okay, one other thought that I had, because you mentioned the fizzy orange was from Thailand, what if, and I think this has definitely been the case for some flavors of certain foods, is that they try some of these flavors in non-US markets, right? They'll try them in Europe or in Asia or whatever, and they'll be wildly successful there because of the local palate and spices and stuff like that. And so they may have developed it for consumption in a different market and then said, hey, we already have the recipe. They've sold really well there. Maybe there'll be some interest in the US or this other market. And so they just start selling a recipe they came up with for a different market in this other one, right? It doesn't really cost them anything else. They don't have to do more R&D. They just give it a shot and see how it goes and see if it sticks. Are you there?
Yep, sorry. Headset was muted. You're right, because they already have to come up with these different flavors for different cultures, because different cultures have different tastes. So if they're already coming up with this other flavor, they don't really have to make a new one. They can just start selling it in a different market. And then that new market, as far as they're aware, it's a new flavor. But it really isn't new. It just has, it hasn't been introduced to this market yet.
Right. Hmm. Yeah. And so what they could do is they could have this whole library of flavors, some that are seasonal, some that are rotational, some that are market-based, and then you just keep shuffling that around, right? And so maybe there's like birthday cake Oreos are on sale in the southwestern U.S. from August through November, and then they go to Brazil from December through March. And then if you really wanted a birthday cake Oreo, all you'd have to do is know where they're distributing them at any given point in time. And you fly there, get your birthday cake Oreos, and then you're happy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the nut. We've cracked it.
Dang, man. We just came up with like a handful of rational explanations for something I just wanted to remain comedic in my head. I don't know. It might. Is that bad? I kind of feel bad.
Well, I think if you look at that question just of what do... basically what do employees of a established product do with their time, right? Like you could ask this question about KitchenAid, right? The mixing equipment.
Oh,
like that design,
yeah,
fundamentally hasn't changed since like the 40s, right? It's this massive cast iron thing. It's over designed as heck, so you can put a bunch of torque through it and it's not going to break anything. The controls are literally just like a little slide lever thing. That has five speeds, whatever. But yet they're still producing KitchenAids. Now maybe the percentage of their revenue that's devoted to R&D is fractional, right? Maybe it's just a tiny amount. I don't know. But anyway, the point I was trying to make is I feel like you could make that statement of what do developers of an established product do with their time. About anything, you could say it about those of us who work at John Deere or people who work at Ford or Chevy or whatever. It's like, are they just coming up with new stuff to justify their existence, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't know. That's the nature of the game. Consumerism, people want different, new, whatever.
Flamin' Hot Oreos. Oh, birthday cake flavored Doritos.
What about a flaming hot Ford F-150.
Oh no.
Or a Mountain Dew flavored Oreo.
Oh, gross. What about a Mountain Dew flavored Ford F-150?
Edible one.
Yeah, like, well, not necessarily edible, but you can lick the paint anywhere. It's like, Mountain Dew.
Or what if automakers started making paint that was scratch and sniff?
You get into a car accident, you immediately jump out of your car and go and start sniffing the scratch.
Yeah, and then like when you do ding it up, right, you'd be a little bit less upset
That's true.
because at least it smells good, you
Yeah.
know. Makes your day a little better. Man, that would be fascinating. It's
Twould.
like crossovers between comic universes, right, or cartoons or any story, but with food instead of with stories or with products, I mean. Also, I feel like I'm hearing the Hound of the Baskervilles outside, but some of the dogs in the house are wrestling or something.
Oh, I haven't heard, I except for right like maybe 10 seconds ago, I heard a dog barking. It's the first time I've heard any evidence of them this whole time.
Sweet. Good deal.
Indeed.
Well, do you want, I mean, we're at about 45 minutes. Do you want to, hold the other topic we're going to talk about for next time? The
What was, oh, the one that we, was this the,
continuation.
I'm
Or do you feel
okay
like you have enough time to finish it up?
you do or don't feel.
No, I was asking if you feel like we have enough time to finish it up.
I think so, because it's really a continuation from last episode. Although I can't really remember what we said last episode. I can never remember that. I can never remember what we actually have talked about. But
Well,
let's
so last
go ahead.
episode we were talking about the differences between subscription models and, versus ownership and transactional models. Like, what are the differences between those styles and how
Yeah.
they played out? And like, you know, renting movies or buying the digital copy or having a streaming service, whatever. So the only piece that I was going to add on to that, which also I think is somewhat fitting because we've been talking about corporations and employees and things like that is how our I think by and large our economy, at least in the US, is shifting. So in a generation ago or maybe two, in some places it's still true, but someone would get a job and they would work at that job for most of their career. So I think if you look at the data, like our grandparents' generation, really, I think they averaged like maybe one and a half jobs in their lifetime. So maybe they had, you know, a job when they were younger, and then once they reached adulthood and got married, they kind of settled into a career. I think that number now for millennials is that they've already or are projected to have like four and a half or five different jobs over the course of their working career. And
Oh.
so there's this big transition from stability, consistency, you know, the employee, the old term company man, right? Like somebody who basically worked their whole career for one company, you know, put in all this overtime, just blood, sweat, and tears kind of thing for that company. That mindset has significantly eroded. And now it's much more, people are going where the grass is greener. And because of the internet, we're able to see where the grass is at least theoretically greener. And so people are kind of bouncing around more, trying different things. Maybe they realize 10 years into their career that they don't like something as much, so they're moving on. Anyway, all of those factors kind of changing the dynamics of employment. What I think we're going to see long term is that, like for engineers, for example, instead of working for a company your whole career, I think we're going to see a significant rise in more project-based or contract-based employment, where maybe you're the leading guru for Python, for example, right? Writing Python code and you know, using that within a company. And so maybe you get hired by a company to help them do something with Python for 2 years. And then you'd go to another company and do that same thing, but for them, because that's what you're really good at. So instead of having a lot of employees who basically migrate from project to project with the same company, you would have a lot more where you get experience and expertise in a given project or in a given area, and then you tend to repeat that type of project with many different companies.
Mm.
That's my conjecture, anyway, is that we're going to be moving in that direction.
Interesting. So the thing that came to my mind when you were kind of talking about how you think we got here, right? There's the question, and we don't have to go down this path, but there's the question of whose fault is it, right? You're right. We don't see a lot of company men anymore. Is that because workers are, like, is it because the companies have really changed, but workers are maybe becoming more aware, more independent, more aware of better opportunities, more individualistic and self-conscious, self-preserving. You know, if I see a better opportunity, I'm going to take it versus stay loyal, even though the companies haven't, you know, changed or not. Or is it because the companies have started eroding the benefits of sticking with a company, where, you know, I know a guy who I met, I can't remember how many years he'd been working at Deere at the time, maybe 10, but his first 20 years of his career, he was with a company. I can't remember where it was located, but he was with a company. And I think he said the first 10 years there was great. And then 10 years into his tenure there, a company came in, and it was one of those corporate, like, I forget the term, but where they just come in and they just gut the company. They buy the company, they gut it, reaping a bunch of money. But then it's like a pit mine where they just come in, they strip it of all of its resources, and then there's just this gaping hole of, what do we do with this now, left over.
Mm-hmm.
Where the company was just, like, ineffective and culture was shot, their product line was shot. But the executives made a lot of money selling off, you know, different subsets or different departments and subsidiaries and whatnot, and changing the work practice. So it's like they're just going to make a lot of money really quickly. So, like, the way that they engineer and develop products changed in a way that it was shoddy, but they made a lot of money fast, but it was obviously unsustainable. Things mm-hmm. like that, you know. So he joined a company probably fully intending to be a company man, but then this company came along, ruined things, and I think he was ultimately let go. So it's like, you know, in his case, you know, that's a good example of the risk of trying to be a company man well outweighs the benefits. You know, what benefit are you going to get by being a company man these days? It seems like not very much.
Yeah. I think there's two observations I would make that I think apply to that situation. The first one being just in general, if you look back several generations, like, as we transitioned through the Industrial Revolution from essentially subsistence farming to then heavy industry, and now we're in this, you know, growing technology boom, the amount of work that any given person in the workforce was performing on a given day has steadily decreased, right? If you think, like, 1800s, basically everybody in the family was working as much as possible, right? Just to put food on the table, to have a warm place to live, right? If you think about the amount of effort it would take today to only put a roof over your head and have food on the table, you would have to work significantly less time to be able to do that. In general, right? This isn't true for everyone, but in general across the population. So which has enabled the standard of living to rise, because now you're able to spend time and money doing a lot of things that aren't just trying to survive.
Mm.
So I think that's part of it is you don't need to work as much as we used to really, you know, live a lifestyle that most people would find acceptable. I think that's part of the reason that there's not that drive there. Is you're like, well, I'm comfortable with this lifestyle. Why do I need to grind to try to get more? And I would also say, to your point of, like, is it really rewarded? I think in the again, going back to older days, a lot of companies, your influence, your position, your pay was significantly based on seniority, right? And you still see this in some places or some industries, but it's basically how long have you been there is the biggest determination of how much money you're making or how, what impact you have in the organization. And if you think about it, that really plays into the hands of the employer, right? Because it's like nobody wanted to leave because you're then back at square one at whatever other company you start at. And so people would stick around because that basically sticking around and being a company man was your way to increase your value or what you're getting for take-home pay. And now I don't see that same, that loyalty, I would say in general, is not rewarded. And I think it seemed to start on the employer side where people were getting squeezed more and more, putting in all this effort and not really seeing reward for it. So they said, well, I'll go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And now it's just kind of, it's kind of become the way things are, where it's just like, it doesn't seem like the people, I guess I'll throw out the term workaholics that are, you know, putting in double the amount of work of any of their peers. It's like, well, you want to be here. You're spending all this extra time, but I don't really see those people getting a benefit from it. They're not getting paid more. They're not getting promotions faster, anything like that. So it just doesn't seem like the payoff is there to be that, you know, foot soldier in on behalf of the company.
Yeah, actually, maybe, you know, you said something right there that triggered something in my brain. There's not a lot of, what's the word for it? Promotions really anymore. You know, like back in when I was a kid, you'd see TV shows and say, all right, good luck, you know, honey, like, you know, like, go get that promotion. And then they come back, oh, he gave the promotion to so-and-so. You don't really see that situation anymore. If you want a better paying job, 9 times out of 10, you have to apply for a different role in a different team. And to tie it all together with this conversation, perhaps a different company altogether. Maybe that's a, yeah. I think that's a big factor too, is that people are saying, hey, I want to move up. I would love to stay with this company, but this company is either, they're not going to offer me a promotion because that they just don't do that anymore. And the only roles available to me are roles that I don't want to do. So the only way for me to get a, to move up on the ladder in the role that I want to continue in may be to go find that same role at a different company.
Yeah, I will say, like, I've had, without changing roles or applying for position, I've been promoted, and I know others who have been. So I wouldn't say that's non-existent, but I think it is less common than it used to be, which I believe is the point that you were making. And yeah, I would say in general that trend. I've heard a number of people say, people that I know who've left the company, who've moved between jobs of other companies, who said basically that it's easier to get a job with a new company than it is to get a new job within the company that I already work for, which is mind-boggling to me. But I think that just kind of shows the trend that I was talking about to kick off this topic, which is that as the barrier of entry and exit to any given company continues to decrease, people's tenure at a given company decreases as well, right? Yep. And maybe it won't formally become like a contract type relationship, but it might just become that in actuality where somebody starts with a company, they do a project that they really like, and then they realize that there are the opportunities they want aren't there for them when that project is over. And so they decide they're going to pull up stakes and move on to greener pastures, right? And maybe they're still a full-time, you know, payroll employee of that company the whole time. It's not a contract thing, but it ends up working out like that just because of the nature of it.
And I would think too, all these companies, you know, starting to really give remote work serious consideration and moving in that direction. I think that's only going to exacerbate this. I don't know if it's a problem or not, but it's going to enable that work structure to develop a lot faster than if we weren't doing remote work. because people would literally have to get up and move to a different town or a different state. And but my kids have friends here. I have friends here, you know. But now that's, you know, if there's remote work, that's not a factor anymore.
Right. Which makes the job market competition between employers just that much higher. I guess, and employees too. That's true. Although one thing I want to ask, did you intentionally make a portmanteau out of exaggerate and exacerbate?
What did I say?
You said exaggerate.
Oh, yeah, I meant exacerbate.
Okay. I thought you were like sneaking in a new word that took on both meanings.
Nope, that was just me being stupid.
Or creative, either way.
Let's do it with that. Creative. Yeah, I like that.
In this case, though, is a weird instance where they work together really well. Like the words have similar meanings, so they kind of just didn't really add much or take much away.
Doesn't exacerbate itself? I think that I don't think that my portmanteau. I don't think that they work together. I think exacerbate means exaggerate in a detrimental way. How do you spell
right.
it? Exacerbate.
It's E-X-A-C-E-R-B-A-T-E.
Something like that. Here it is. To make more violent, bitter, or severe.
More violent?
I guess.
Yeah, I would just say generically to make worse.
Yeah, but I don't think Merriam-Webster can leave it that simple. It has to, it has to sound more technical.
The people writing their definitions need to justify their jobs too.
Yep, looks like it. But exacerbate is frequently confused with exasperate. There's exacerbate and then there's exasperate. I can see why people would get that mixed up. Even if they know the difference between the words, if they just slip and say one when they really meant the other, I can understand that. And with good reason. Not only do these words resemble one another in spelling and pronunciation, they also at one time held exceedingly similar meanings. Exasperate is today most commonly used as a synonym of annoy. But for several years, it also had the meanings to make more grievous and to make harsh or harsher. Exacerbate is now the more common choice of these two words when one seeks to indicate that something is becoming increasingly bitter, violent, or unpleasant. It comes in part from the Latin word acer, meaning sharp. Oh, I think that's also where the company Acer gets their name from now that I think about it. Anyway, but it's Latin, so the C would be a hard C. Comes from the word acer, meaning sharp, whereas exasperate is from asper, the Latin word for rough.
I think the company Acer, maybe it's sharp. I was going to say, though, it also means maple in Latin, right? Like Acer rubrum is a red maple.
Oh.
So I wonder if they were going for maple.
Let's just find out. It was founded...
The other comment I was gonna make to distinguish those two words is I think in today's usage, exasperate largely implies that at the other end the recipient is a person, whereas exacerbate is a situation. Right? So a situation is being made worse, a person is being exasperated.
Ah, I can see that. I'm not finding where the name Acer for the company came from on the Wikipedia.
Let's call them.
Yes.
Hi, yeah, quick question. can you tell me where the company name came from?
I'm still not finding it. Huh. Interesting. Don't know. We'll never know.
We'll never know. All right. Well, with that cliffhanger, I think we've got a pretty good place to wrap it up for this episode.
I think we do.
Good deal. Well, thanks for joining us, and we will catch you next time on Tangential Banter. Until then,
that's a lot of care. Nuts!
I had to.
I wondered where you went with the soundboard, and then you just snuck it in there at the end. Well played. Well played, Jack.
That's what she All said. Right.
I just couldn't find any good times to do any buttons. So next time,
serious of a topic.
It was next time. Next time, we'll have better.
All right.
See y'all.